Hi, I'm Josie. My daughter turns 5 today. I'm also an Ohio State Highway Patrol trooper. When you move over and slow down, you're making sure I can get home to celebrate with my daughter.
When you see flashing lights, remember, they're not just roadside workers. Thank you for moving over and slowing down.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Mike Rothmiller and Douglas Thompson draw on previously secret LAPD intelligent files, a cache of FBI documents released to the authors in 2021, and extensive interviews with prime sources, including many who worked with Frank Sinatra and many more who tracked his long and fatal association with the American Mafia, notably his ongoing connection after his original godfather was assassinated, Sam Momo Giancana, shared a lover with President John F. Kennedy. 16 days after the assassination of John F. Kennedy on November 30th, 1963, while the singer was consoling the president's widow, 19-year-old Frank Sinatra Jr. was kidnapped at gunpoint from his hotel room in Lake Tahoe, Nevada. A $240,000 ransom was demanded from his father. While the FBI and Nevada and California law enforcement agencies sprang into action, Frank secretly contacted his mafia friends for help. The mafia believed they could free young Frank much more quickly through their underworld connections. In the end, 9 people died, having been beaten for information. Revealed here as never before is the extent to which Sinatra was adopted by the mafia. They promoted his career and watched his back, and in return, Sinatra danced to their tune. New information disclosed here shows that Sinatra also offered to spy for the CIA. Inside sources say Sinatra wanted the CIA to intercede to stop an investigation to his gaming license in Las Vegas. But the CIA declined because they were already working with the mob and were concerned Sinatra would learn of the mafia's connection to the CIA and leak it. The book that we're featuring this evening is Frank Sinatra and the Mafia Murders, with my special guest, journalist, author, and former organized crime detective, Mike Rothmiller. Welcome back to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Mike Rothmiller.
My pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much for this interview, and congratulations on your latest book.
Well, thank you.
Let's start with your background. I just mentioned organized crime, former organized crime in LAPD. Tell us about your background, the information that you were privy to, you and Douglas Thompson, your co-author, and the origins of this book and all the research that was necessary.
Sure. Well, my background, I started with the LAPD. I was there 10 years. I worked patrol. I was a training officer on patrol. I worked vice enforcement, and I became a sergeant, and I was field supervisor. And the last 5 years I was there, I was assigned to the Organized Crime Intelligence Division. And what then entailed is gathering intelligence on the mob, politicians, on anybody that wielded power, not only in Southern California, but across the country, and in some cases, in foreign countries. of the 55 detectives that were in there when I worked there, we never made one arrest. We were prohibited from making arrests because of the intelligence that we are gathering and how we were gathering it. As an example, we had two guys in there who were wiretap experts. That's all they did, even though you couldn't get a wiretap. There were other guys that would do black bag jobs like the FBI used to break into a house, break into a business in the middle of the night or middle of the day, search it, get the information they want, and then leave.
Right.
And so that's what was going on. If you think of J. Edgar Hoover and what the FBI was doing, gathering dossiers from the rich, the famous, and politicians of power, that's exactly what LAPD intelligence was doing at the time. And that actually started in 1932. That division started, and it continued through the years. I had access to all of the secret dossiers and files on everybody you can imagine. There probably were 50 to 100,000 people in the files.
Wow.
And of those were entertainers, as you can imagine, Sinatra, Marilyn Monroe, politicians, the Kennedys, Jerry Brown, the governor of California, his father, Pat Brown, former governor, and people from various countries. And with a emphasis on New York, Chicago, Detroit, Miami, Kansas City, and those areas of Las Vegas, where there was a mob connection, but also where there were, well, let's just put it this way, a lot of politicians that were in the pocket of the mob. So That's where it came from. That's what I had access to. I had access to a lot of the very confidential information the FBI had because I was loaned to the Department of Justice Organized Crime Strike Force in LA. So I was working with them a lot. IRS intelligence provided us a lot of information and so forth. So that's where all the information was coming from when I was doing that sort of work. Now, as far as this book, gathering information, it went back to the information that I had privy to many years ago when I was doing that work. And then also, I filed many Freedom of Information Acts and mandatory declassification reviews for information that has never been released by the FBI, the CIA, State Department, Secret Service, you name it. And I also got a lot of information out of the National Archives and out of old data banks that we subscribed to. So it was a wealth of information. And it was also a matter of running down former law enforcement people who had information back then, and also people who were close to Sinatra and who knew what he was doing as far as his connection to the mob and what the mob were doing for him. So we found quite a few of those people who were still around and they're willing to talk. So that's the background where the information came from.
You write originally in the book chapter called The Sicilian, and you talk about Frank Sinatra's Sicilian origins. Tell us a little bit about his background and what his parents did and his ascension as a singer in America.
It's very interesting. He was born in New Jersey, and his father was a hanger-oner of the mob back then. He would do some work for them. He wanted to be a boxer and his bartender and so forth. And he was running some errands for them, be a better way of putting it. His mother was also involved in an abortion clinic. And so Frank grew up watching the mob guys around him and watching his parents. So anything that was being done as a child that normally your parents do when you grow up and their associates, you think it's all right. You think that's the way the world runs. And so that's where he grew up. And he started working very young in some bars and so forth. And he would sing as he got a little bit older into his late teens. He would sing for a sandwich and maybe a pack of cigarettes in the local bar that was run by some of the mob guys. And that's where he got his first taste of the mob and a first introduction to the mob. And they liked him. He was a good kid. They thought he could sing. And so they became friends. And as time went by, it was the mob who, Lucky Luciano, some other guys, through Willie Moriarty, who was his, for a better term, his godfather, they put up $50,000 to advance his career. And that's what really launched him to what we know today, what happened to Frank.
He also learned early on about breaking contracts because he had a contract where 43% of his money went to Tommy Dorsey. Tell us about that contract.
Right. People may have seen that before in a movie, but it was very true that Dorsey had him locked in for Bedford for life in 43%, and he wanted out of it. And so he went to his godfather, Willie Moriarty, and He, along with another guy who was an enforcer and worked for Murder Incorporated, they went and paid him a visit, Dorsey, at his facility, and they had a chat with him, said, either you drop the contract, buy it out for a dollar right now, or you're going to die. And basically the hitman pulled out a gun, put it up to him and said, sign the contract away, in which he did. And because of that, Frank was very, very happy, one, because he got out of it, but two, now he owed the mob a great deal. And he paid for his entire life.
Tell us about his ascension as a performer. And you had mentioned that the mob was spending money to be able to help his career. But tell us how the mafia controlled the clubs and in his ascension as a performer. And before we introduce Sidney Korshak and Johnny Roselli.
Yeah, well, he, as I said, performing in mob clubs, for a better term, whether they were large or small, around New Jersey, then to New York, and they would have him come in, they would pay him whatever they paid him for that night's singing, and he was indebted to them. And so they kept expanding that. So, well, we want you to go here and play for so-and-so at his club. And he would do it, he'd get paid. And also that helped him start to be established as a singing star. You think of any major entertainer today that started out very young, a singer. And so you have the groupies and the young kids, and in his case, it was the young girls, the teens and everything, started following him. And that's where it all started, his fan base. And they just kept that going through their various clubs as he expanded out.
Tell us about Sam Giancana and the relationship that develops between Sinatra and him.
Sam Giancana was, at that time, the godfather of the Chicago outfit. He was running the Chicago Mafia. And he was, Momo was kind of a crazy guy. He had a hot temper, but he knew enough to keep it under control at times. And Sinatra went to him and wanted to get to know him because he knew he could elevate him in the entertainment world. And Sam took a liking to him. It was kind of like an uncle and a nephew situation, a father and son. And he took him under his wing and he would help Frank along the way. If Frank ran into difficulties, he couldn't get a singing gig somewhere. All Sam had to do was make a call and all of a sudden he got the gig. And so that was the help that he was giving him. And also when Kennedy, John Kennedy, was looking at running for president, his father, Joe Kennedy, contacted Sam Giancana and Frank Sinatra. And Frank met him at his house and they had a long talk. And he said, listen, I need basically the mob's help to get John elected in Chicago and on the East Coast. And Frank went to Sam Giancana and they had a long conversation about it. And he said, sure, we'll help him and we'll see what can be done. And they, for a better term, they bought him the election through cash and intimidation. So that was a long-standing relationship. And also, as time went by, there's a Cal Neva Lodge out in Nevada, it's up in Lake Tahoe. And Frank was the guy who supposedly owned it, but it was really Sam Giancana put most money into it. And so Sam would go there undercover. He wasn't supposed to be there because of gaming restrictions. And he would stay in a little cabin. And Frank would go there. And also what would happen is Joe Kennedy, the patriarch of the family, he would secretly visit and they would supply him with prostitutes or anything he wanted. And so that got Sam in to know a great deal more than he wanted to know probably about the Kennedy family, but also to get them in line in his mind. And as time went by, a gal named Judith Exner came to know Sam through Frank and she became his girlfriend, Sam Giancana's girlfriend. And at the same time, she was introduced to John Kennedy and she was also taking care of John Kennedy. And so that was rather interesting because now Sam Giancana had blackmailing information on John Kennedy. So one day there was a wiretap on Hoover's people, put a wiretap on Sam Giancana's home in Chicago. And Kennedy was president, and he called to speak with Judith. He didn't realize it was Giancana's home. So Judith was there. She starts talking to John Kennedy, and he's being recorded the whole time. And so that was a great coup for J. Edgar Hoover, because after Hoover heard the tape, he had a meeting with Robert Kennedy, and he said, I want you to listen to this tape. And he listened to his brother talking to this gal about what they're going to do and what they've done in the past. And he said, do you know what phone number that is? And Robert King didn't know. And says, that's Sam Giancana's house. That's Sam Giancana's girlfriend. And your brother is also doing Judith Exner. So at that time, Hoover was basically way ahead of the game as far as blackmailing the Kennedys and knew that he would never be fired because of the information that he had. So it was a very long-term, very in-depth relationship and agreements that were made between Sam Giancana, Frank Sinatra, Judith Exner, and the Kennedys. It sounds like a movie, but it's all too real.
And what was Sinatra supposed to do in his role? What were they counting on him to do specifically?
The mob or the Kennedys?
The mob.
The mob. Well, the mob, what they were hoping for and they thought they would get is that once they were tight and they really got the election, they took John Kennedy over the threshold to become president. They thought, this is great. They owe us, because they thought Joe Kennedy, they made the deal with, and that Joe Kennedy, from his past bootlegging and everything, that he would, for a better term, keep the deal. And so they were looking for just no involvement of the FBI or Department of Justice just coming after the mob activities, whether it was bookmaking, whether it was running drugs, whether it was prostitution, extortion, whatever. They thought they're going to have a free hand in their territories to do what they wanted to do. But what happened is Robert Kennedy was appointed attorney general, which they never saw coming. And he started to investigate them and go after people in the mob. And so they felt betrayed. And there was no love lost at that point between the mob and JFK and also Frank Sinatra, because he was the middleman during all this. And so they were upset with a number of people, but they didn't know quite how to handle it at that stage.
Frank Sinatra being the middleman, but what were the people that were in the crosshairs of Bobby Kennedy related to Frank Sinatra?
Well, a lot of them didn't have a direct relationship with Frank Sinatra. They're just mob guys and different families throughout the country. And out of Chicago, a lot of the mob guys never met Sinatra. You know, they were buttons, they were lower down soldiers and everything. But what you always do in an organized crime investigation, you try to pick off the low-hanging fruit, because that way you can get them. They're the ones that are out there doing the crimes, for a better term. And you can start to squeeze them and hopefully turn them into rolling over the person that they work for. And you keep going up that chain of command. So that's what they were hoping for as far as DOJ. And the mob were hoping that that would never happen, but it started to happen. So they were picking off lower hanging fruit guys. That was causing a lot of stress to the mob, because they didn't know when these people would start to turn informant. And they were also focusing on the higher ups, some of the mob bosses they wanted to take down. So it was a very intense time as far as investigation of the mob, and then the mob starting to fight back. So it was a situation that started, basically a war that started, but nobody knew how it would end.
You chronicle part of this in your book, your incredible book, Bombshell, about Marilyn Monroe and Bobby Kennedy and John F. Kennedy's role in her death. You talk about Frank Sinatra and Marilyn Monroe and being a middleman in a different way with the Kennedys.
Yeah, and Bombshell is just how he was, for a better term, setting up Marilyn Monroe and the Kennedys along with the help of Peter Lawford. And so that's really where the introduction came with Marilyn Monroe. And then the affair started with Jack Kennedy. And after he, for a better term, backed out for whatever reason, then his brother, Robert, was the man to tell him that Jack was not going to be seeing you any longer. Then he started an affair with Marilyn. And it continued. And at that stage, it was interesting because Peter Lawford was put in the middle, but also Sinatra was still, if you want to say, friends with the Kennedys. And Sinatra, at his house in Palm Springs, had a wing built on, because it was his understanding, it was agreed to, that John Kennedy was going to fly in the Southern California as president, and he was going to stay at Sinatra's house in Palm Springs. And that was shut down after he built a huge add-on and brought new telephone lines in for the Secret Service and everything, because Robert told him about his connections to the mob, which John Kennedy probably already knew, but he hadn't had it laid out for him that way. And that it would have been a very bad idea for the president to spend time at Frank Sinatra's house in Palm Springs, because there were a lot of mob guys down there at the time. So he backed out at the last minute. Sinatra was furious. And Sinatra, at that point, basically started to hate the Kennedys. And he also started taking it out on Peter Lawford, because Lawford was, at that stage, he was a brother-in-law to the Kennedy family. And Sinatra was not happy at all. And also, at the time, Peter Lawford was married to one of the sisters of Kennedys. And Sinatra started having an affair with her so he could get closer to the Kennedys. And this was backing it up a little bit in time. Excuse me. So he was very upset that after having an affair with Peter Lawford's wife, the sister of the John and Robert Kennedy, that everything fell apart. And he thought he was going to be so close with the president into the White House. But his connections to the mob hurt him in that respect.
Yes, the relationship suffered somewhat as a result from that. There was some name calling. Tell us more about the campaign against the U.S. Mafia.
Well, it was ongoing for some time once Robert Kennedy came in. He expanded the number of investigators he had, DOJ, attorneys, prosecutors, assigned just to going after the mob. And then he would send in groups of attorneys and investigators from the FBI and DOJ into cities such as Chicago, Detroit, New York, to start just focusing on the mob, to go after them, to try to get as many of them as they could indicted. And that was his main quest. And there were some indictments. There were a lot of interesting situations where they basically interviewed Sinatra, but he wouldn't come into a hearing situation. They had to go to his hotel and interview him over connections. And naturally, he denied knowing anything, knowing who these people were and so on. But everybody knew he was lying at that stage. But the investigations went on really until JFK was assassinated. And then they started to wind down. But it was a very intense investigation. It wasn't for lack of trying, but it's difficult to indict mob bosses without one of the capos below them or soldiers becoming an informant. It's nearly impossible. And so they went on as long as they could, but once Kennedy was assassinated, it was pretty much over.
Shortly after his assassination, we mentioned in the introduction, something happens regarding Frank Sinatra and his family.
Are you talking about the kidnapping?
Yes.
Yeah. Shortly after JFK's assassination, Frank Sinatra Jr. was playing at a hotel in Lake Tahoe, starting a singing career, and he was kidnapped from his hotel room. And nobody knew who did this at the time, but he was tied up, he was gagged, he was put in the trunk of a car. The people kidnapping were driving to LA. And so when Frank heard about it, you would think that the first call would be to the police, the FBI, because he could have gotten a hold of the head of the FBI and said, "What's going on? How are you doing this? How are you handling the investigation?" Well, he didn't do that. His first call went to Giacomo, because he, as most people then, thought that it was probably some mob guys who kidnapped him. And the next call, after Sam Giacomo said, "Okay, I'll look, I'll see what I can do, I'll get my people on it," so forth on the West Coast, his next call went to Jimmy the Weasel Frediano, who was in Los Angeles. And Frediano was mobster going way back. He was the hitman who killed a number of people and so forth. And he said, "Sure, we'll get on it right away and see if we can find your son, find out who kidnapped him and free him." Because Sinatra thought that would be the best way to handle it, because they were more likely to find these people quicker than the police would. So that went on. And the Weasel went out to people that he thought, for whatever reason, could have been involved or had knowledge of this, because they also thought it was some mob guys that probably pulled it off. And three of those guys turned up dead, and a good number of other ones just vanished and never been seen again. And as it turned out, the people that kidnapped him were, for a better term, like some old high school friends that thought this was a great idea to make some money. And they were captured after Frank Jr. was freed in Los Angeles. So they weren't in the mob. They had nothing to do with it. It's just like some college kids getting together and deciding, "Hey, we're going to go kidnap somebody for ransom." And that's pretty much exactly what happened. And they were all eventually captured and convicted. So that was the backstory of what was going on in the shadows when his son was kidnapped.
At the same time, he still owed a favor, or still owed just yet another favor to Sam Giancana, didn't he?
Oh, he owed Sam Giancana for many, many things. One of the things was in the movie From Here to Eternity, Sinatra wanted the part. The studio wasn't going to give it to him. And they went and had a chat. Sam sent his guys out to have a chat with Cohen, who was head of Columbia Pictures then. And basically it was, no, you're going to have Frank. You're going to give this part to Frank or you're dead. And that's how Frank got the part. So that was one thing. And then Frank owed a lot to the Chicago outfit, the Chicago mob, because they really pretty much launched him in Southern New Jersey. And there were a couple of brothers who he was extremely close to, the Fischetti brothers. They were cousins to Al Capone. They worked directly for Al Capone. And there are a number of people died at their hands. And so anytime Frank, pretty much anytime he would go back to Chicago in that area, one of the brothers or both would pick him up at the airport and he would stay with them at their house. And those two brothers, and he would go with them, just hang out with them the whole time he was there. And he did a lot of favors for them, such as a couple of the guys back there were opening up car dealerships, and he would show up for the grand opening as a favor, or he'd do a commercial for them. So he was indebted to them. And also, I think he probably feared them because he knew what they did for Al Capone and some other people and what they were doing for Sam Giancana at the time as Sam was taking over. So there was some fear and there was some respect. But Frank had an enormous respect for the mob, and he was just intrigued by them like they were movie stars. And it was him and Phil Silvers who would get together, and they would just admire Bugsy Siegel when Bugsy was in L.A. And they would just, for better term, treat him as the king. And when Bugsy would walk into a restaurant and they were there, they would stand up and say, hello, Mr. Siegel, how are you this evening, and so forth. And then once he passed, they would sit down and they would do favors to him. If Bugsy wanted dinner with them or have a friend have dinner with them, they got it. They would do it instantly. And once again, that was a lot based on respect, but respect and fear. And they would talk about Phil Silvers and Frank about how many people Bugsy killed and how did he kill them and what was his preferred method of killing people and so forth. And they were just intrigued by that. And so it appeared through the people who spoke to that Frank started taking on that persona as, boy, Bugsy is a tough guy and he's got a lot of respect. And so if I'm his friend, people are going to have more respect for me and more fear. So it was an interesting dance that they were doing between them, but Bugsy was always the one on the West Coast that they bowed to. And then they would pay a lot of attention to Jimmy the Weasel. He would do things because they knew he was basically just a hitman. So there's fear and respect going across Sinatra's lines.
You have an interesting story about Mario Puzo and The Godfather and Frank Sinatra's interest in that movie and Sidney Korshak's role in the whole thing as well. Can you tell us just briefly about that?
Yeah, well, Sidney was an attorney in Los Angeles, Beverly Hills, and he was probably one of those powerful people within the entertainment industry. He represented a lot of entertainers, a lot of studio execs, but also he, for a better term, wielded power over the unions in Los Angeles. And so when he wanted something done, all he had to do is make a call. And he got Frank into a lot of things as far as movies and entertainment. But also Sidney had the power. If he wanted to shut down a studio through the unions, he just made a call and nobody would show up for work at the studio. So he wielded a lot of power. And then as time went by, Frank had him represent him a number of issues. And he would then act as the middleman between whatever Frank wanted and whoever he wanted to get it from. And people knew Sidney. They knew his reputation. They knew that Sidney was very well connected with the mob. And there were a lot of rumors that there were probably some people that got some broken bones and were killed because of Sidney. But he was very sharp, very shrewd, and extremely powerful in Hollywood.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is ZipRecruiter. It's tough to run a business and hire people for your business, especially during the holiday season. Soon, many businesses are hiring for festive jobs, like turkey catcher, bilingual Santa Claus, coffee and nut gift basket assembler, and reindeer wrangler. These are all actual jobs on ZipRecruiter. And if they can fill these roles, they can find the employee you are looking for. ZipRecruiter uses its powerful technology to find and match the right candidates up with your job. It simplifies the entire hiring process. ZipRecruiter also has an easy-to-use dashboard with a complete suite of tools that lets you filter, review, and rate your candidates. Discover hiring joy with ZipRecruiter. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See for yourself. Go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/murder. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, Mike, we were talking about Frank Sinatra's desire to be in The Godfather and then him being rebuffed by the director, Ford Coppola. And tell us about what happens a little bit later in a chapter you call Candid Camera.
Well, Frank wanted The Godfather, but he just wasn't right. And the studio did things right. And Coppola apparently didn't really want him in there. He was thinking some other people, which ended up being Brando and so forth. So they tried. They tried to get him in. But for Sidney Korshak and them, for some reason, they just couldn't swing it at that time to get him into that movie. And he was a bit upset because if you've seen the movie, the original Godfather, you see there's an entertainer who was a singer, and the Godfather played a very important part in getting him into a movie and launching his career. And that was all based on Sinatra. Mm,
yes.
So it just was an interesting situation where it was really kind of, in a better sense, a docudrama on Frank's life, just that one part in there. And it looked like he wanted to be in there in a sense to, one, try to control the part and what was being said. And also, it seemed to be a good job for him to take at the time if he could get it, but it just didn't work out.
You write in this book, and we haven't spoken about it, the behavior and the attitude of Frank Sinatra and some of the, I guess, his affairs and some of the things that he did that the mob counted on and used to their advantage.
Yeah, well, Frank, he had quite a few affairs. And as you met, a lot of them were public, some of them were not. But he saw himself in a way as almost becoming untouchable in the mob's mind, that he was up there with the mob godfathers and so forth. So a lot of the people around him and within the entertainment industry and within the mob, they were getting upset because he was drawing a lot of attention to himself that the mob felt it wasn't necessary as far as having an affairs. And they wanted him to really calm down, slow it down. You know, if you're going to have an affair, basically have it in private, have it with a prostitute out of Vegas or someplace else where nobody's going to know about it. But he insisted on doing things in his own fashion. And then he became jealous of Ava Gardner. He started dating Ava Gardner. And then she went out a couple times with Peter Lawford, this obviously before Peter was married. Mm-hmm. And he was so upset, he called Lawford, basically threatened that he'd better never be seen Ava again, go out with her or anything, where he's going to take care of him. And that's where Frank was coming in, playing his mob role, and thinking that the mob is just going to whack somebody because he's upset with them. That's not the way it worked. Mm-hmm. And so Frank went on like that. That gave the FBI a lot of reason to investigate him, put wiretaps on and so forth on his phone and other people's phones, and put him under surveillance when he was in various parts of the country. And that's the same thing LAPD intelligence did when he was in LA, had him under surveillance. And when he was living in Palm Springs, LAPD intelligence would go to Palm Springs and see who he was getting together with as far as a woman, see what mob guys he was meeting with, and just carry that on to the end point where they get as much information on him and the mob and anybody who he associated with. And so that's pretty much what went on with him and having affairs. And there was a time when he was drawing too much attention, and some of the guys in the mob talked about having him hit, killing him to stop the attention. And several wanted him hit, but then, if you want to say cooler heads or people higher up the chain of command, the mob said no. They were worried that if they did that, one, he was a moneymaker for them. But two, that would draw an enormous amount of heat from law enforcement as far as somebody who looking at who killed Frank Sinatra. So they just backed off at that point. And then you have to get into when he had a gaming license that he lost in Nevada at the Cal Naval Lodge. And so he later, as time went by, years later, wanted to become, for a better term, director of entertainment at a major resort in Vegas.
Right.
And once again, he had to go through the gaming commission to get that license. So it was reported, the information we got, he was going to get paid $125,000 a month for that job. And all he would do is help bring in other big name entertainers to perform at this casino resort. So it wasn't going well. Harry Reid, who was a former senator out in Nevada, he was on the gaming commission, and he vowed, spoke publicly and in private to many people that Sinatra was dirty as far as his involvement in the mob and so forth, and he would never give him a gaming license. Well, now we step back to Sidney Korshak, the attorney in Vegas. Sidney had a very good friend who was an attorney in Nevada and a very high-ranking politician there for years in Nevada. And so they had a meeting. That attorney went back to Vegas and called Harry Reid and said, we need to chat. So they got together in a motel room. They had a chat, and Harry left with a briefcase from this guy. And it was obviously full of cash. And so shortly after that, the vote was coming up for the licensing of Sinatra. And Harry, over that meeting in the hotel room, said, Sinatra's a great guy. He's got a lot of great friends. And boy, we've got to give him his gaming license. They gave him the gaming license. So this brought in a lot of the politicking that went on in Nevada at the time, and especially with Harry Reid. You know, Sinatra, he knew what to do, and it was basically his attorneys that came through for him on that. He ended up getting his license.
You write about his connection to Carlo Gambino as far as the government is involved, and you call them the boss of bosses. What comes of that connection in terms of photographs showing they were together?
Well, in the book, there's a photo of Sinatra and about four mob bosses and then some other capos together. It was after a show we did. And Carlo was the man. He was the most powerful mob boss in the country and probably in the world. And so that's who Frank wanted to be around. He wanted his power, his protection, and his endorsements and his influence by being with him. So that's what he was hoping to get out of being around Carlo. And Carlo at that time, he was an old gentleman, and said, yeah, I'll go see Frank. And he took his friends, and they went and they met him. And then through time, when Carlo was still in power, through Frank, generally through an attorney, would contact Carlo and ask for a favor. And sometimes they were big favors, sometimes they were small, but Frank was not overextending his request to Carlo for any little thing, because he knew that Carlo would get upset if he kept calling and asking for loads of favors. Pretty soon Carlo's going to cut him off. So he was selective in his request to Carlo and his people, but Carlo, if it wasn't going to cost them anything, literally anything, he would make a call, and or whatever his people would make a call for him, either on telephone or in person, and say, hey, would you help Mr. Sinatra on whatever the issue was? And generally, people would not refuse him.
You write about a seemingly...
For those who embrace the impossible, the Defender 110 is up for the adventure. This iconic vehicle has been redefined with a modern design that lets you go further and do more. The exterior is reimagined with compelling proportions and precise detailing, complemented by an interior built with integrity. The Defender capability is legendary. Whether you're facing off-road challenges or harsh weather conditions, its durability has been tested to the extreme. Powerful innovations like the intuitive driver display and award-winning infotainment system keep you connected. Innovative camera technologies deliver unobstructed views and effortless maneuvering. And robust cargo capacity means more room for your gear. Ready for a wide range of adventures, the Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender.
Have you heard? Sling TV offers the news you love for less.
Hey, wait, you look and sound just like me.
I am you. I'm the same news programs on Sling TV for less.
You mean you're me, but for less money?
A lot less. I'm all the favorite news programs and more on Sling TV, starting at just $40 a month.
Everything great about me, but for less money?
Which makes me greater, don't you think?
Get the news you love and more for less.
Start saving today. Visit Sling.com to see your offer.
Sling.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey, and Sophie Rundle. Discover new BritBox original series like Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy, BAFTA-winning drama Time, and new crime thriller After the Flood from the producers of Happy Valley. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly. Only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.
Hey there, I'm Brad. I'm about to win the Tuesday Night Bowling League Championship. I'm also a highway worker for the Ohio Department of Transportation. When you move over and slow down, you're making sure I can bowl the winning strike with my buddies.
Remember, they're not just roadside workers. Thank you for moving over and slowing down.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Similar ransom and kidnapping of his son, Emmanuel Manny Gambino. Tell us what happens in that case.
Well, it's just a matter of, once again, there was a kidnapping, and Carlo, being in the position he wasn't going to stand for this, and he wanted to try to get his son back, but also he put his people out on the street, all of his soldiers, and they just spanned out across really the country to find out who was involved in this and to basically take them out at the end. There were quite a few people that ended up vanishing. Some ended up just their body being found. And it was just proof that when there's a mob boss, especially back then, there's a mob boss that has a lot of power. Carlo had it. You don't mess with them. It doesn't matter what your position is. You didn't mess with them. So Carlo did his best, like any mob godfather would do.
Jesus has an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now, we talk about what happens with Frank Sinatra and his career at this point and afterwards, but also the fate of people around him like Sam Giancana. Tell us what happens with Frank Sinatra and his career, and what happens in the careers of some of these mobsters that you read about.
Yeah, well, it was interesting that when John Kennedy was president, the CIA wanted to kill Castro and a number of other political leaders. So they went to a guy named Robert Mayhew, who was a former FBI agent, former CIA operative, who was working for Howard Hughes at the time, and basically asked him to set up a meeting, the mob, and he did. And so they got together with some of the mob bosses and said, hey, here's what we want. We want Castro killed. And so Sam Giancana and them thought about it and said, okay, we'll see what we can do. And they came up with some ideas, but obviously it never occurred. And Johnny Roselli was one of them. Johnny, the mob guys, Johnny was out on the West Coast. That was Hollywood Johnny. And he was really into running the mob's interest in the studios and so forth. And so as time went by, all of a sudden, Congress and Senate, they started investigating this, the issue of the CIA being involved in killings and so forth.
Right.
And Sam was set to testify. And he was at his house. It was real interesting. He was at his house in Chicago. And he was in there preparing a meal for himself, or frying some sausage and peppers. And somebody he knew came in, and it was, in all likelihood, it was Tony Spilotro, came in, and as Sam turned his back on him, shot him, killed him, shot him in the head several times. That happened just before he was to testify before the commission, the Senate committee. And then Johnny Roselli, who was also involved in setting up the deal to kill Castro, he was set to testify before the Senate, and then he vanishes. And his body is found stuffed in a 55-gallon drum floating in Florida in a bay.
Wow.
So it was interesting, intelligence-wise, it doesn't matter, well, did the mob kill them, or was the CIA, or was it the mob doing it at behest of the CIA? And so that came into play. You got these two guys killed, which it spooked Sinatra to a great extent, because he knew these guys, and he knew them well. And so he was so concerned that, among other reasons, but to get a game license, he went to the CIA and offered to become a spy for them. And basically, they listened to him, and he said, listen, I can get in, see people all around the world, heads of state, the royal family in England, and so forth. And I can talk to them, ask them questions, and I can come back, and you can debrief me with what it would come down to. And the CIA thought about it, but they didn't take him up on it. They took other people up on it, but they didn't take him up on it, because they were mainly concerned with Sinatra learning, if they started dealing with Sinatra, that he would somehow find out that the CIA was only dealing with the mob, with Sam Giancana, Johnny Roselli, all these guys that Sinatra knew. And they were very, very concerned that he would leak it in some fashion, either bragging about it or what. But he wanted their help, the CIA's help, in stopping the FBI from looking at him and also getting his gaming license back in Nevada. He thought they could override everything. But the CIA, they were, in this case, they were smart enough to know that, no, we're not going to take Frank under our wing and have him start doing, if you want to say, undercover operations for them. It just wasn't going to work out. They didn't trust him because he was a loose cannon, and he had a temper. So that's not what you want in a person who's going to be doing intelligence work for you.
You write about the OCID holding a huge dossier on Sidney Korshak and his clients and friends, you say, which include the biggest names in entertainment world at that time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. When I was in OCID, I said I had access to all the dossiers. And Sidney was known, my goodness, for years and years before I went in OCID, about his connection to the mob and his power over a lot of the unions in Los Angeles and other parts of the country. And especially with some politicians. And so going through his file, it was interesting to see how many powerful people within the entertainment industry, I'm talking about heads of studios and heads of television networks and major, major entertainers, for instance, Sinatra, Dean Martin back then in that time frame, Sammy Davis and the Rat Pack, everybody else, plus the Vegas crowd, all the people that owned hotels and casinos in Vegas, they were all connected, and Sidney had access to all of them. It was really quite remarkable because he didn't do a lot of, if you want to say, legal work in the respect that most attorneys do. He just had to make a phone call, and he could shut something down or he could make something happen, and he could put people together. He could just call the head of the studio and then several major actors and actors saying, hey, be at my office tomorrow. I want to talk. And they'd get together and they'd chat and he'd work out a huge deal. So he was more powerful than people know. And interesting enough, for not being an Italian in the mob, he had, in some respects, more power than some of the mob bosses did because of his impact on unions and his say-so over the unions in Hollywood. So Sidney was a real interesting character, had a massive dossier on him, as he did on many other people. And there were times, I know I read the reports where intelligence reports, surveillance reports, where Sidney would travel someplace in Southern California and OCID would follow him. And there were times that he had middlemen go to the White House
Wow.
When various presidents were in office, and have a private meeting with the president. And we, on a couple occasions, when I was over there, tried to get the log from the White House who visited, when he visited. Strange thing, those people were taken off the log. They were never logged in. Yet we know from some of the Secret Service people that they actually met with the president. So there's a lot of power being wielded, a lot of back doors that were being opened, a lot of political favors that were being paid to politicians, and then coming back the other way to entertainers from the politicians.
You write that Sidney Korshak knew how the mafia made Sinatra right from the beginnings, and also how he made it always as easily as possible for Frank Sinatra. He really made Frank Sinatra, didn't he?
He did. Because of his power, he also saw money there with representing Sinatra. So he learned of Sinatra coming up, and in his, I would say, teen idol days, he knew who he was. And as he started going up in stature within the entertainment industry and being known, Sidney got more involved. And that's where Sidney started representing him and running interference for him. And if Frank had an issue with whoever it was that didn't involve the mob, Sidney would step in and handle it. And so Sidney, in a sense, became his godfather in the legal terms of being his attorney, but he would also control a lot that Frank did. And he would keep Frank out of trouble too, because Frank said he had a temper. He would do some stupid things at times. And Sidney was able to tap all that down, keep it out of the media because of his power. And also the influence he had on LAPD, on the police departments at the time. Sidney could step in and have somebody, the case just drop, or it would never be handled in the first place. It would just go away. So he said, I'll handle this. Don't get involved as far as the police. And he would go directly to the chief of police in L.A. And all of a sudden, it was over.
You say that Frank Sinatra, lifelong denial of having any connection to the mafia. But you say Frank Sinatra wasn't a made man, but the mafia certainly made him.
Exactly. That's what his life and his career boiled down to. They took him under their wing. They turned him into what he was as far as entertainment and becoming a superstar. And they would protect him when it benefited them. And that's the way his entire life went. But also when he became older and a lot of these mob guys had died off, his power base within the mob also died off.
You write in the postscript, you call it Showstopper. Frank Sinatra dies at 82 years old in West Hollywood in 1998. Tell us what his send-off was, tribute to Frank Sinatra.
Well, there's a lot of tributes that were paid through the media and so forth regarding his send-off. The vast majority, probably 98% of the mob guys that he knew, that he dealt with, they were all dead. And so it wasn't, as some people may have expected, a big mob turnout to send him off to the cemetery. It was just, for a mention, almost low-key. There were all entertainers and everybody else attended, family, friends, and so forth. But as far as the mob in attendance, there were a few low-ranking guys that were there that were picked up on surveillance, but names that people wouldn't know, but they were all dead by that time.
You write in the very end, in author's note, in August 2022, tell us what you have to say about history.
Well, history can always be, in a lot of respects, rewritten with facts. And a lot of times, history is blurred from the people who've written history and spoken history. And history, too, can be changed. And it can open a lot of people's eyes when documents that have been hidden for years, decades, start coming forth. And they tell a different story for the public perception of the film. Any person, whether it be the Kennedys, whether it be Sinatra, whether it be any major entertainer, all of a sudden you start finding out things you never knew. And you realize that not only in entertainment, but in political, that people are groomed in a certain way. And only a certain part of their reality is exposed or given to the public. And so that's how people read them. And that's how they understood Frank's life until things started to come out. And that's how they understood most politicians' lives.
You talk about the Freedom of Information Act and the changes to it in 1984 and the FBI reluctantly releasing its declassified files. And these were invaluable to you. Tell us what you have to say in terms of these redacted files, but the value of these wiretaps.
Oh, it's quite amazing. Like I said, the FOIAs that I have filed with them, a lot of times they'll come back. If they don't want to release it, say, we don't know what you're talking about. Well, I've gone through that many times with them. Then all of a sudden I laid out why they know and why I know. And then they'll give me documents. And so it opened up a lot of people's eyes to Sinatra and politicians, everything, but all the documents that were coming forth that I was able to obtain. And regarding the transcripts on wiretaps and so forth, what you come across are the actual words, what a person is really thinking, especially a politician, and right. what they're really talking about. And so it gives you a great deal of insight to them. And as one example, unrelated, I got the telephone transcripts of Lyndon Johnson the day after JFK was assassinated. And it's very telling when you read what he's speaking to somebody on the telephone about. And then when he comes out publicly, talks about the assassination, you say, wait a minute, something really stinks here. So when you have access to telephone transcripts, it provides keen insight into the person's thinking and what they're actually doing. And it doesn't matter what they say publicly, whether it's an entertainer or a politician, you know what is really going on. And so looking at that, when all of that information starts coming out, it just paints a different picture of that individual that you're looking at. So they're extremely useful, those sort of documents, and they're extremely informative.
I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about Frank Sinatra and the Mafia murders. For those people that might want to take a look at this and other work of yours, you do any social media website? Can you tell us about that?
No, I don't. Just go to Amazon.com for books and put my name in the search and all the books pop up. And I guess on Sinatra, it's available in the U.S. now in audio and in Kindle, but the paperback won't be out until January.
I see that. Thank you so much. Yeah. Frank Sinatra and the Mafia Murders. Thank you so much, Mike Rothmiller. You have a great evening.
You too. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Josie. My daughter turns 5 today. I'm also an Ohio State Highway Patrol trooper. When you move over and slow down, you're making sure I can get home to celebrate with my daughter.
When you see flashing lights, remember, they're not just roadside workers. Thank you for moving over and slowing down.